Welcome to Write Through the Roof, the podcast for writers who want to improve their craft. I'm Madeline Diest, and in this show, I'm interviewing writers of all different types and asking, what's that one thing that took your writing to the next level? So come and join me and learn all the proven tips, tricks, and techniques to take your writing right through the roof. Through the roof, and today I'm speaking with Angela Savage. Hi, Angela. How are you going?
Hi, very well. Thank you, Madeline.
That's great. Okay, a little bit of an introduction about Angela. So Angela is an award-winning crime writer based in Melbourne. Her debut novel, Behind the Night Bazaar, won the Victorian Premier's Literary Award for Unpublished Manuscript. And in 2011, she won the Scarlet Stiletto Sisters in Crime Short Story Competition. She has a PhD in creative writing. I think you're my first doctor of creative writing I've had on the show. And you're currently the director of Writers Victoria. So that's welcome fun. On
Thank
the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Not a problem. Okay, so how I like to start off is a bit of... And we're face-to-face here, as usually it's on Skype, so you can actually see that generally when I ask this question, I do make movements. Some warm-up questions, sure. Some kind of jogging on the spot, some calisthenics. I actually do this every time, but no one else gets to see it. So do you write every day?
At the moment, I'm trying to. It was actually, funnily enough, inspired by one of your interviews, Madeline. I think it was with Charles Chu.
Yeah.
And he talked about someone who'd actually come up with a collection of short stories that he'd written during his daily commute. And I thought, you know, I've got to stop saying I don't have time to write and just use whatever time I have available. So I have been writing on the daily commute, even standing. There's certain pens that lend themselves to writing when you stand. And I work 0.8 full-time. So ostensibly that's to have one day a week to write. And it took me about 6 months to actually pull that off, but now I do have a day a week of writing as well. So yeah, I'm opportunistically and if I'm not writing, physically writing every day, I'm thinking about the story every day and letting those, you know, characters hanging around with my characters and things like that, doing the work of the couch, as Murrell Day calls it.
The work of the couch.
She says, to the outside observer, I might look as if I'm just lying on the couch, but I'm actually, you know, problem-solving plots and developing character and all of that kind of thing. It's nice, isn't it?
It is. It can be used so many times. Oh, sorry. No.
No, I'm busy. I'm writing.
So you've written short stories and novels.
Yes.
So what's your favourite?
I love all forms of writing. I mean, I love songs. I wish I could write songs. I just love the brevity of song. I think there are some, you know, I love the way that certain writers can tell an entire life story in a song. You know, people like Bruce Springsteen, Tom Waits, you know, I just love what they can do. Steve Earle. So ironically, I probably, the form I love is the one that I'm no good at all, and even my short stories aren't all that short. So I'd probably have to say I lean towards the long form end of the spectrum, but I read both short stories and novels, and I love both. Mm. Yeah.
Okay, so you're writing on the train.
Yes.
And you're writing at home, but yes. Do you have a writing fuel of choice, which might be hard on the train?
Yeah. Oh, well, I can still manage a coffee occasionally. You know the famous Hemingway quote about, you know, write drunk, edit sober. Sometimes a glass of wine at night for the night writes can loosen the imagination and it'll allow you to take a little bit more risks. Of course, it's like, though, drinking and playing pool. Like, you've got to find that beautiful, happy point where your game becomes better because you've got the confidence, the edge of confidence that just the right amount of alcohol gives you before you overdo it and your skill drops off at an alarming rate. The odd glass of wine, the coffee, the walks actually is the other thing. And I was interested to see that a lot of famous writers incorporated walking into their day as an important part of their creative process. So also try to fuel the problem solving with walks.
Mm. So that's not your time on the couch.
No,
it's a similar process.
That's right. It's a bit more. It's a bit less sedentary. That's right.
The
not so sedentary version of couch time.
Mm. Good. Okay, so we've got to know you a little bit more. So how do you describe your writing and what particular themes do you like to explore?
When I started out, I had been living in Southeast Asia for the better part of 7 years, in Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia and Thailand predominantly. And I think there was a degree to which my writing was inspired by the fact that no one wanted to listen to my travel stories. And, you know, so I'd had this kind of momentous, life-changing experience and no audience for it. So I think there's a little bit of that motivation. But I was really interested in, and I still am interested in, culture and how we are shaped by our culture. And, you know, Australians in particular, we have this notion that we don't have, I'm talking Anglo-Celtic settler Australians, that we're not the ones with culture. Everyone else has culture. They're all the others. Mm. And we're like the default. And there's nothing like living in other countries where you are in the cultural minority to make you realise just how shaped by your culture you are. So I was kind of very interested in those questions and sort of shining the light back the other way. So all the sort of drama and the tension, but also the humour that comes from that kind of cross-cultural interaction. And so that's sort of one theme I think that's fueled my books. I think all of us to some extent are driven by character and by human nature and, you know, plumbing the depths of what makes people the way they are and what, if anything, changes people. So they're sort of questions I think that I'm coming closer to as I write more. And now having, you know, I did live back in Cambodia in 2008 for another year, but that was 10 years ago. So I've spent less time in that part of the world in the last 10 years. And I think that's starting to be reflected in my writing, which is moving closer to home. Mm. That's sort of, there's some of the thing. And I guess the other area that's always interested me is reproductive health. I worked for 10 years in HIV education back in the early days before the treatments, and then worked in sexual health and family planning. And my PhD novel was about surrogacy between Australia and Thailand, because that kind of ticked a whole lot of, boxes for me in terms of my interests. So I still have that kind of ongoing interest in reproductive health and reproduction, in technology, in kinship, notions of kinship, genetics versus caring relationships, all of those kinds of things. So I love reading about that stuff, and that also informs a lot of my writing projects.
Mm, they're quite unique themes.
Well, they probably hark back to books like The Handmaid's Tale, which was what released in 85, I think. And I remember reading that very early on in the piece, and Marge Piercy's Woman on the Edge of Time as well. And so there was a kind of spate of really interesting feminist fiction around, and it was when IVF technology was just starting to kind of come into its own. And so I was being there at sort of the cusp of that, I think, and I've stayed interested in those developments ever since. And, yeah, I just find it a really fascinating area in terms of, you know, I said before about we're all interested in human nature. I think that's a particular filter or a particular lens that I like to look at human nature through and see what that says about us.
Because very morally it's quite grey.
Yeah, it's very, very, and it's, you know, you've got extraordinary relationships of power, science, technology, culture, as well as these kind of almost primal urges around reproduction and stuff. So, you know, an urge which, if it's not universal, certainly transcends class, race, gender, sexual orientation, you know. So it's big. Mm. You know, there's a lot of very big stuff going on, and I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, it was enough to write a PhD about.
Cool. Okay, so the big question I like to ask, which some people find a bit hard. So, what do you think is the one thing that's improved your writing?
That is an interesting question. The piece of advice that I got when I first started out, which was the most useful to me, came from my dear friend Christos Tsolkas, and he said, just get the story down. And I think up to that point I was just, you know, I'd be spending day in, day out crafting the perfect opening paragraph and, you know, with the thesaurus, finding the right word. And, you know, it took me a while to realise that a first draft is just a first draft, that chances are you can't write the perfect opening of your novel until you've written at least once from in its entirety, because you need to know how it ends in order to know how it begins. And when I teach writing, I often will show students examples of beginning and endings to novel and say, tell me that author could have written that opening without having written that ending. You know, E. Annie Proulx's The Shipping News is a classic one to start with. So that was extremely helpful advice from Christos, that just get the story down. It's just a first draft. And I think that's something that all first-time writers really need to learn. Since then, I think probably, and in an ongoing way, what improves my writing is still reading, like reading great work, reading other really great writers. I have studied writing more in the last 5 years than I have previously, because I just went into writing without having actually studied formally. And then I've gone back to do the PhD, and that has involved a fair bit of study as well as tutoring in creative writing. So that's introduced me to technique and other things. And I guess what I've learned from that process is that, you know, writing is a craft. It's a process of continual improvement. You never stop learning. I still go to class whenever I can. I went to a master class with Charlotte Wood recently. It was mind-blowingly good. And in that respect, at the moment, just most recently, I think the thing I'm trying to learn the most about is the judicious use of verbs. I know that sounds really boring, but I really do believe that good, strong writing comes from using simple words in a really compelling way. And Kim Scott is wonderful at this, and Michelle de Kretzer is another one who's wonderful at this. So reading their work and learning from their work and then going back to my work and doing what Charlotte Wood refers to as bettering that work by... You know, can I use a better verb here? You know, can I cut that verb and adverb and make it a more specific verb? Can I use something that's more evocative? You know, so that's sort of where I'm at the moment in my writing.
So how do you, when you're doing that kind of critical reading, how do you switch between reading for getting swept up in the story?
Yes.
And getting into the nuts and bolts of it? So
that is a great question. Because it, you know, I have written crime fiction. My first three novels are crime novels, although the one I wrote for my PhD isn't. And having written a lot of crime fiction and read a lot of crime fiction, I'm a really terrible crime fiction reader, because most of the time I'll be going, I know what's going to happen. And, you know, so I really admire an author who can wrong-foot me or one who will keep me completely absorbed even though I know what's going to happen. And I guess I think that reading, I think it's about partly about the mix of reading. Like, I think it is, you know, sometimes you just want to read for pleasure. You're reading to be entertained or distracted.
Yeah.
And then other times, even when you start a novel, sometimes this is the case for me, I'll start a book and then suddenly be... taking out my pencil, I'm a margin annotator. Yes, I don't bend the corners back, but I do draw in the margins and underline things. And so, you know, I'll be reading a book and then I'll find myself picking out the pencil and marking things up. So it's shifted from reading purely for pleasure to reading with a view to learning what the author's doing. I do think... I don't think one necessarily has to detract from the other. And a good author will be one that where you, I think probably some of my favourite writing is where I'll read it through just gobbling it up because it's so incredible and engaging and riveting, and then I'll go back and go, whoa, what did I just read? What did she do in that paragraph? You know, where are the bits I'm going to underline? And I think the last book where that happened was... I think I got round to last year's Stella Prize winner the week this year's Stella Prize when it was announced. So I read Heather Rose's Museum of Modern Love, and I just adored that book. And that was one where I did that, where I was reading and just swept away and then going back and marking up at the same time.
because I am at this point now where I have to try and remember, especially I'm quite ruthless with my reading, so if, you know, I'll go to the library and get a stack and
yes.
go, all right, yes. so you've got 50 pages.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, yeah.
if even that. Mm. And so I'm trying to get into that headspace of going, okay, well, what has put me, made me shut the book?
Yeah.
Rather yep. than just going, oh, this is awesome.
Yes. And I think that's good. I was going to say it's also good to learn from, you know, writing that, shall we say, diplomatically needs more development or needs better editing. I do a lot of manuscript, or not manuscript assessment, but I do reading for emerging writers. I've got a mentee, a woman who's writing short fiction that I mentor. And I will, you know, as part of the culture of reciprocity that I think exists among writers, I'll often read for friends and get them to read for me. Mm. And sometimes, you know, I enjoy that process because of what I learn from it as well, that, like, when I can see what it would take to improve the writing, it's like, oh, yeah, okay, I'm on track. Mm. And it's... that's kind of helpful. I think it's the trick is to get the right mix again of those of writing that's, you know, could be improved or could be better edited. And when you see things that could be better edited, it's sort of an example of what you've internalised in terms of your own learning.
Mm.
But also to read really great fiction is, I think, you know, essential to writing really great fiction. I'll often say to people who want to write crime fiction, for example, you know, read one of Gary Dish's standalone novels or Peter Temple's. Like, they are masterclasses in how to put a crime novel together.
I just read a Patricia Highsmith last week and it was just like, yep.
Yeah.
She knows what she's doing.
Oh, yeah. You're in safe hands. That's exactly
yeah, exactly.
It. That's exactly it.
So, I'll let you have a sip of coffee. So,
fueling myself.
Yes, fueling yourself. Are you trying anything new at the moment?
Actually, I'm trying... Well, I'm writing short fiction at the moment because with the new job at Writers Victoria, newish job at Writers Victoria, I figured it would be a while before I had the headspace to focus on longer form. And I've been trying to write a non... crime short story, which is new ground for me.
Mm-hmm.
Although I also then got an idea for another crime short story. So, you know, there's always, you know, must be the way my mind works. I keep, you know, say to people something about crime writers. We go and visit a new place. We're into this beautiful environment and all of a sudden our imaginations start populating the landscape with dead bodies. You know, it's just kind of this occupational hazard. And, yeah, so I think sometimes my mind just... And it's interesting, I did some research into why crime fiction is so popular amongst readers, and there's neuroscientific evidence to suggest that the classic whodunit plot line, for a lot of people, the way people's brains are wired, not universally, but for a lot of people, it's this process, I think it's called meta-representation, where you take information on... under advisement, you store it, you come back to it, you reappraise it, the more information that you get. And apparently it actually creates a pleasurable experience. And so there's a kind of... Some people's brains are just... Or a lot of people, if you go by the popularity of the genre in both film and written form, a lot of our brains are wired to enjoy crime fiction, to enjoy solving a puzzle like that.
Mm.
So I think maybe my brain is one of those brains and it likes to write those puzzles as well as...
It's that little step further. It's creating the puzzle as well as enjoying.
So I think there's a little bit of a default there, but I am also trying to write non-crime stories. And in fact, one of the pieces I'm working on is historical, which is new ground for me as well.
Mm. I'm always scared off by all the research.
Yeah, well, I think... I'm kind of I have my own personal archivist, which helps. I've got a fabulous friend who's just wonderful at this stuff. But also I think it's about, I think you can overdo the research. Val McDermott, the Scottish crime writer, once said to me, she does all her research before she starts writing.
What once said to you?
Yeah, so big name drop there, wasn't it? Yeah, she... Look, actually, Val comes to Melbourne quite often for the Sisters in Crime.
Oh, does she?
And, yeah, she loves the Australian Sisters in Crime. So I know I had the great pleasure of interviewing her 1 year, and she's awesome. She's great fun. And we also spent, like, about 3/4 of an hour in the green room together waiting to go on stage and just kind of hit it off. So we've... Anyway, she said to me that she does her research before she sits down to write, and if she can't remember a detail, chances are it doesn't belong in the manuscript. It's too much detail, and you can, you know, you can overdo the research sometimes. So I think getting a feel for something and then taking that kind of consciousness into the writing without overdoing it. Yeah, I mean, that said, I have enormous respect and admiration for historical fiction writers. You know, I love what they can do, how they can evoke and, yeah, terrific stuff.
Cool. Well, you've talked about a few writers that inspire you, but are there any others that you... that you failed to mention so far? You've referred to quite a few people so far.
I know, and I do love. It's very hard when you're in a job like mine to actually single out specific writers because it's like I'm playing favourites. But I have to acknowledge that the first novel I managed to read after I finished my PhD, I could not read anything. Yeah. I was just like, I had brain overload, was Emma Viskitch's second novel, and Fire Came Down. So I have to sort of doff my cap to Emma. I think she's doing a great job as a contemporary crime writer. And at the moment I'm reading Julie Coe's magnificent short story collection called Portable Curiosities, and I'm just, if it's possible to kind of fall in love with stories, that's what I'm doing, just extraordinary. So that's just two things that I'm reading at the moment. But for a long time I've been a big fan of Barbara Kingsolver's work. Like, I love what she does with, you know, she's got ideas, books, issues, books. The Poisonwood Bible is one of my top five favourite books of all time, and I was lucky to hear her speak at the Adelaide Writers Festival recently, and she was just so admirable and interesting. So I think that's definitely a standout writer for me. And Christos Tsolkas too, I should mention. I think he is such a generous and hardworking and brave and interesting writer and friend. You know, it's he's very inspiring as well.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, so before we started, you spoke to me about how you have a new short story in a new collection.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this is very exciting. So I was contacted earlier last year by Head of Zeus, which is a publishing house in UK, and they were putting together, Sophie Hannah, who's a very popular UK crime writer, was putting together a collection called Deadlier, which was like the 100 best crime stories by women. And they accepted a piece from me called The Odds, which was actually inspired by my PhD research. This is, you know, where things go when you're doing your PhD. So I'd been reading a lot about the IVF industry, and it actually has a 70% failure rate. So 70% of people who go through IVF don't leave the process with a baby. And I found it astonishing because it grows, I think, economically, financially. It's now the biggest company in Australia's floated on the market, and it grows at about 10% a year. And I'm thinking, what other industry in the world could have a failure rate of 70% and be growing 10% a year, other than maybe the weight loss industry?
That's what I was
going to
say.
Yeah, which is like, yeah, or targeting women. So so I kind of, and where's the rage about this? Like, and I think partly we don't get the rage because the overwhelming response is one of grief. So I've kind of reimagined a scenario where a woman who had been through that process, who hadn't come out the other end with the child, took revenge on her IVF doctor. So that story is called The Odds, and that's in this collection called Deadlier. It's a beautiful doorstopper of a book. It's astonishing to be in the same company as Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and all these astonishing Daphne du Maurier. And then there are four of us Australians in there. There's Kerry Greenwood has a story, Emma Viskitch, who I mentioned earlier, has a story, and myself, and I think the fourth is actually Ellen Davitt, who wrote the first, I think she was English born, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't speculate too much about that, actually. She's the woman whose name is given to the Sisters in Crime Davitt Awards for the best crime fiction written by women, an annual prize. And, yeah, she wrote Force and Fury, which I think is supposed to be the first full-length detective novel or crime novel written and published in Australia.
Mm.
Yeah.
Oh, that must be very exciting.
Mm, yeah, it was great. So it was really exciting to, yes, to be part of that project.
Yeah. Okay, so what are you working on now? You did mention a short story.
So two short stories. One that's, as I say, one that's kind of a crime short story and one that is historical fiction, and both are written from the perspective of young girls, and that may be a reflection of the fact that I have a 12-year-old, so I'm actually hoping for her to do a sensitivity read on one of these stories to make sure I've got the voice right. So is this how a 12-year-old would respond to this? And it's kind of great talking through the story. She also loves writing stories, funnily enough. She's got two parents who are writers, so it's kind of inevitable. But she's, you know, she's a kid who actually analyses what she's viewing, for example. She looks at tropes, and she looks at, you know, editing in film and sees what's happening and sees, about, you know, she's learning about subtext. So she does get, she's got an extraordinary sense of how story is structured. And I have been just, I just sort of chat with her and say, in this situation, how would a girl your age feel and that kind of thing. So that's kind of fun to do the research with her, and I will get her to do a reading through of the story to see about the voice. And then the other one is a little trickier because it's a much older. Yeah, as I say, it's set in the 1920s, and it's a younger child again. So we'll see. I don't know if I'll pull that one off yet, but I'm going to give it a go.
Always trying something new.
That's it. That's it.
Okay, well, I'll wrap up now, and I'll let you get back to your busy day. I see you've got emails and things to approve.
Funding submissions to read through and all of that fun stuff. Looking after Victoria's writers, as we do.
And good work you do too. So if people want to get in contact with you, where can they find you online?
So I have a fairly poorly maintained website at www.angelasavage.wordpress.com where you can leave me messages, or you can also find me on Twitter. My hashtag is ANGSavage, and I'm responsible for the tweets at Writers Victoria as well, so you can find me through either of those means.
Excellent, and you often live tweet events.
I do, yeah, that's my kind of Twitter specialty, is live tweeting events, and also consult, you know, asking questions, getting feedback from people through Twitter. So I'm really always happy to hear from Victorian writers, especially Writers Victoria members. Not that we play favourites, but we do we do play favourites. If you're a member, you get a much better treatment from us than if you're not.
On Twitter.
On Twitter, that's right. Please join.
All right, well, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Madeline. That was really fun.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Write Through the Roof. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe or spread the word by writing a review on your listening platform of choice. And if you'd like to get in contact with me, please go to madelinedst.com or madeline_dst on Twitter, no apostrophes. You can find the show notes for this episode on madelinedst.com under the Write Through the Roof tab. And until next time, what are you going to do to improve your writing this week?